You're listening to World Affairs. I'm Philip Yun. As tensions between Trump and Xi Jinping intensify, China is pursuing its global ambitions through a massive infrastructure project known as the Belt and Road Initiative.
Great powers rise and fall. China's making a big bet that this is one of those times. With China building around the world, roads, railways, ports, pipelines, power stations, 5G systems.
And if you control those, you don't need to control any army anymore. You are controlling the very specific wealth of any country along those economical corridors.
Most of the world's countries have signed on.
Mary Kay Magstad, former Beijing correspondent for NPR and PRX, has partnered with local journalists on five continents to tell the story. Her new podcast is On China's New Silk Road.
Whatever you think of it, the New Silk Road could change the world in ways you'll want to know about.
We see these ideas of censorship, of control, of surveillance starting to crawl out to other parts of the world, and that people need to understand that if it doesn't concern them now, if things continue like this, then it probably will concern them in, 5 or 10 years. And at that point, it'll be too late because Chinese influence will be everywhere.
Marcos Kounoulakis takes it from here.
Mary Kay Magstad joins us now, along with Shuang Li, a journalist and filmmaker from Chengdu, China. Could you talk about how China and those within China are understanding and really adapting to this new reality of China's prominence in the world? Mary Kay?
So I lived in China for 15 years, in the 1990s and then in the first decade of this century. And over that time, I saw this extraordinary transformation where villages became towns and towns became cities and people's incomes doubled and doubled again. And everything started moving very, very quickly toward China moving from just aspiring to become a major economy to becoming one. And along the way, it also became a power in technology and innovation. And I think that there is a sense of inevitability in China that developed over the course of that time, and particularly in the lead up to and after the Olympics, of now is our time, this is our century, we are going to be the greatest power in the world, and this will be good for the world.
By the way, that's a bit of an unsettling perspective for many of those in other parts of the world.
Yes. I guess it depends on where you sit. So I've actually, in the course of my reporting for this podcast series, been in a number of different countries. And say, in Ethiopia, people think very positively, a lot of people do, about Chinese investment and the positive impact it's had on their economy and on their lives. In other places, like, say, Cambodia's port city of Sihanoukville, people really don't like the way that Chinese money has come in. They don't like the sense that their city has been taken over and has become almost Chinese. There are all kinds of perspectives in the middle of those two extremes.
Right. But back in China, this is happening all around them.
So I think the Olympics were a real turning point. There was great aspiration leading up to then. And then immediately after the Olympics, if we all remember 2008, came the financial crisis. And Chinese leaders, you could sort of see them looking at each other and saying, I guess the United States isn't that invulnerable after all. You know, in fact, they kind of really royally messed up. And look at us. You know, we are in a position where we can keep moving forward. And that's what we're going to do. But also, that was an interesting moment because Europeans who, you know, were having a hard time said, you know, hey, can you help us out? And the Chinese government said, well, we think you have the wisdom to handle your own problems. So it was like, okay, so what kind of global leader is China going to be? Not necessarily one that steps in at moments of need for other countries.
So that's how official China saw itself. And that's how the leadership understood its role suddenly and perceived of its place within the world. But how then does that play in the streets of China? I guess addressing you, Shuang, since you were living there at the time, did you and your peers really perceive of your country suddenly stepping up and stepping out on the world stage?
Yeah, I agree to what Mary Kay was saying regarding the 2008 Olympics. I remember for the longest time when I was growing up, I really felt China was this small country in the world. The economy is not that great compared to a lot of the Western giants. But the Olympics really the peak of our optimism and the confidence. And after that, it seems like China is doing really good, especially the financial crisis. China wasn't hit that bad during the financial crisis compared to the US and other countries. And then 2013, China started the One Belt, One Road. It's a very ambitious project. China has never been short of announcing these big projects. Great Leap Forward in the 50s and all the way until now. But then those are all domestic projects. I guess this is the first time that such a project of this scale is announced on the international stage. But I feel people inside China, their attitudes towards this project is like the ones that we have towards the projects in the past, which is, if you ask everybody, have you heard of One Belt, One Road? And everybody will be like, yeah, of course, it's everywhere, right? It's on the walls, it's on your TV. But if you ask them what it is, most of the people that I talk to have no idea. They probably know, we built a railroad in certain country, but then they don't understand the whole scale of the project.
And in the podcast, Shuang, you reflect on your personal experience as one of millions of Chinese people who was sort of witnessing a historical transformation without really knowing it.
I remember the early years when China was building the high-speed rail, and a lot of people were very skeptical of this is such a huge investment. How can you get back? But then just within a few years, it completely changed the way that people travel. Yeah, one thing that I have to do when I go back home right now is I need to use a map whenever I go out to visit friends and family, because everybody have moved at least 5 times after I moved out in 2002. And then also all the roads are bridges. They build a road and 5 years later they torn it down into a tunnel. So the city is always changing. And I guess people's idea of what a city is like, what development is built up in this constant building. I think the only thing that does not change is the change itself. And I think when people think about China building things in other places, I think that's what they think. This is how things should be. Things should not stay the same. They should always build. And if China now has the power to export our building power to other countries, then it's a great thing. Look at our roads. And I remember, I would say a decade or two decades ago, the government has this Develop West campaign, which they were trying to push to get investment from the coast all the way to the west, and which Chengdu was an important place for receiving these investments and development. And people were really, really happy at the time, feel like, oh, finally, the government is looking this way. We're finally getting this opportunity to grow. So people's idea of this whole project, I think it's all very positive, even though they probably don't know what exactly it is.
Mary Kay, you were a foreigner living in China. Is that your experience as well, that there's a great deal of gratitude and satisfaction with the Chinese populace, with both their governing structures and the Chinese Communist Party that's delivering these goods to people, that's delivering this extraordinary growth?
So I think there's a lot of genuine pride in China's growth, but I think a lot of credit, almost full credit, needs to go to the Chinese people and to the Chinese government for having gotten out of the way to let Chinese people use their energy and their drive to achieve everything that's happened in China over the last 20, 30, 40 years. The government has had policies that have encouraged certain kinds of growth. At the same time, the Communist Party doesn't necessarily have a lot of tolerance for criticism. So it's hard to know what the average Chinese citizen feels at the moment in terms of the balance between pride in China's growth and China's place in the world versus suppression of rights. And I think a lot of people don't even necessarily feel their rights are being suppressed. As long as they're not pushing against the edges and challenging those in authority, they may not ever feel it. That's the experience of a lot of middle-class Chinese in cities. I think rural Chinese have experienced more frustration at the very least, and sometimes repression at the hands of local officials. And of course, in Xinjiang, where Uyghur Muslims live, hundreds of thousands, possibly more than a million, according to international human rights organizations, have been put in detention camps over the last 3 years because the government basically is suspicious of possible extremism, whether it's Islamist extremism or separatism. So that is a whole different experience and a gross human rights violation. But within China, the rest of China, Han Chinese China, over the entire time that I was there, there were tens of thousands of protests every year. In fact, the police were releasing figures about protests up until about 2010. And I think the last year they released them was 2010, when it was something like 180,000 protests around the country. So as long as these were local protests about specific issues, whether it was land grabs by local officials or environmental issues from polluting factories, and people weren't organizing with other groups in other parts of the country, the government felt it could contain these protests and kind of deal with them, sometimes violently, sometimes not.
Yeah, and I think the government, the central government, especially the central government, they have learned the ability to turn these protests sometimes to help them. They have the ability to portray it as, see, there's a corrupt local official, and then we come in and to make it right. So it's not the system itself has a problem. It's your local official has a problem, and we dealt with the problem.
Yeah, and actually there was one time, there have been a couple of times where the government has encouraged or at least wink, wink, nudge, nudge, like been just fine with protests that happen against other countries' claims to the South China Sea, against Japan having school textbooks that didn't mention atrocities against the Chinese during World War II. But even with some of those protests, like I remember one where students marched to the Japanese embassy. I think this was in 2005. And then some of them were like, let's go to Tiananmen Square. And the police were like, no, don't.
What one should take away from all of this is, of course, that China is a very large country. It's complex. It has different strata within it. And that the attitudes and even the benefits that those who experience the growth within the domestic scene are uneven. And you have done a great job of pointing that out in your podcast. Can you talk a bit more about some of the other parts of the Chinese culture and groups?
So I would say that one point of tension that started to cause a fair bit of friction right around the time that Xi Jinping came to power was the wealth gap in China, that increasingly the elites, including some family members of top Communist Party leaders, were amassing significant wealth. And while incomes had risen for many people, I think most people in the country over the course of the last 20, 30 years, the wealth gap in China was even greater than the wealth gap in the United States. And that in a Communist Party was a little strange, given the rhetoric that people grow up hearing and learning when they're in school in China. You know, certainly there were frustrations about corruption in the government, but also in general. I remember hearing when I was in China, 2003 to 2013, a lot of people lamenting that they felt that there wasn't enough. There's a word in Chinese called suzhi. It's like being civilized, being refined, being cultivated, being, you know, civil to each other. You know, that people felt that this was somehow missing in society and that there weren't enough things that were being passed down from on high that were helping build that kind of cohesiveness in society. So there's all of that, plus the fact that while there was great growth and a lot of building, a lot of construction in China throughout the 90s and the first decade of the 2000s, it started slowing down. And China's population overall has been aging, and the workforce had started to contract. So there has been this moment where the Communist Party was facing a situation of, we'd better do something, or we're going to have companies that don't have a way to make money, and we're not going to be leveraging all of the fruits of our labor that have built up to this point to try to be the great power in the world that we've always known that we want to be, and that we feel China should rightfully be, and that it was for centuries. So now is our moment. Let's start this Belt and Road Initiative and take our expertise of building out into the world and build in a way that helps countries on the receiving end, but also helps our interests, helps us cement our vision of China being the center of the world.
And that's where you pick up, because you actually go around the world, whether it be Africa or Europe or Latin America, and start looking at these projects, talking to local officials and people who are affected, some of whom are able to be employed by these new projects. And you really take a deep dive, but a grassroots look at what it means for this Belt and Road Initiative and for these various countries as these infrastructure projects are being put into the ground, what it means to them economically, politically, and what it means globally with, in regards to geostrategy. So what were some of your favorite places to visit and some of the more surprising things that you found on your extraordinary peripatetic journey?
Well, let me start with Ethiopia, which is actually the country in focus along with Africa in the last episode of the series. And I start there because I actually did my master's thesis on Ethiopia, and I was there in the 80s. And when I was there, they were just coming out of one of several famines that Ethiopia had had. It was a very poor country with a very repressive government under Mengistu. One of the things I remember when I was there was that when I was out in the countryside, when people would see me, a non-Ethiopian, someone who had lighter skin, they would say, "Cuba, Cuba, Cuba," because Cubans had come in and helped with various development projects in Ethiopia. This time it was China, 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 because Chinese had been all over Ethiopia building roads and dams and, you know, railway links and other projects. And in remote villages, people knew, you know, we've seen Chinese here. They build stuff for us.
They are proactive to help us, everything, even if behalf of us. So we admire Chinese. That's why when they came and we give everything, as much as possible to support them. And they do everything smoothly. We don't have no interruption among us.
I don't mean to make it an entirely rosy picture, because even in Ethiopia, there was some criticism of Ethiopia taking on too much debt and the debt repayment schedules being too short and it, you know, feeling a little uncomfortable. But at a grassroots level, what the Chinese leadership had hoped would happen on the ground and how it would be received by ordinary people seemed to actually be the case there.
Right. And that's where it contrasts, in fact, with some of the other countries of the world and how they perceive of what is being built and the presence of China and Chinese workers on the ground on the African continent. As you know, Mary Kay, since you are so familiar with Ethiopia, it's right next door to Djibouti. And Djibouti is an interesting case because the United States has long had a naval base in that country. Why don't you pick up from there?
And now China has a naval base not far away. And Djibouti is on China's Belt and Road as well. It's New Silk Road. And so there's a lot of investment going into Djibouti, building up a free trade zone. But also, it's clearly part of a dual use proposition for China. You know, we're going to help your economy. We're going to help ourselves by having a strategic position, which also is important because if you move along the waterway, you get to the Suez Canal. And China has looked strategically at how it's making its investments along the New Silk Road. There's a strategy in China called the String of Pearls, which refers to having a presence in different ports all the way from China to Europe, going through the Middle East. Djibouti would be one of those ports. Gwadar in Pakistan is another one. Now Hambantota in Sri Lanka is one. And the idea is that this would certainly help to protect trade that's important to China. It could also potentially help have harbors and naval bases for Chinese ships should there ever be a conflict. So you can look at various investments all along the way and see ways where any of these ports could potentially be used for either purpose. And in fact, Chinese state-owned enterprises are told by the Chinese government that when they're building in ports, when they manage ports or they take partial ownership of ports in different parts of the world, this is also true in Piraeus and in Greece, that the specifications should be such that Chinese naval ships could use them too. So that doesn't necessarily mean that China's preparing to go to war, but I think that China, as a rising power, as a superpower, as a power that looks at what the U.S. has done over the last few decades, at what other rising powers have done over time, thinks, you know, we need to be thinking big. We need to be thinking long term. And we need to be thinking about how do we project our power and how do we protect our interests all around the world.
And is this a new way of thinking for Beijing, this idea that the Chinese state should actually be playing at a global level, that it should maybe try to achieve regional hegemony in parts, that it really has to have a military that can project power in the far reaches of the globe? Or is this something that's always been a part of the leadership in the Middle Kingdom?
I think China has always wanted to be the center. When I was growing up, we were nowhere near a global powerhouse. But then there's always this perception that one day we will gonna be, and then when we are, we're not gonna be something like the US. We will not be aggressive. So the line is always, when we are the world powerhouse, we will not be aggressive. We will be very peaceful. So it's called our peaceful rise up.
But then it's pretty funny that right now they've got the wolf warrior diplomacy going, huh?
It's so fascinating. And so was the justification for, or rather the rationalization for China not really stepping out, not building these capacities to project power over the years? Was it this century of humiliation that actually suppressed what was a natural expectation within China and amongst its populace?
Yeah, I think China, the narrative and or the propaganda inside and outside China is very different. So if you look at what's portrayed of what China is doing in the South China Sea, or what China is saying towards Taiwan, or what China is doing in Hong Kong or Xinjiang, it's all portrayed in a very different way inside China. None of this is aggressive, and people don't view it as aggressive. For example, if you look at from a Chinese perspective, what we were doing in the South China Sea, it's because those are our islands. We're just trying to protect what's ours. There's nothing aggressive about it. Why are those countries pointing those fingers at China? And when you talk about Xinjiang, it's our land. We're just trying to deal with the terrorism problem. Why are you criticizing China fighting terrorism? So inside China, even though China has been more aggressive on the world stage with whatever it's doing, also with the wolf warrior diplomacy. But inside China, people don't view it as aggressive. And people also thinking, well, 100 years ago, you were way more aggressive towards us. I think China's resistance to the quote-unquote humiliation has become very, very aggressive from diplomats, politicians, all the way down to the people. So every time they see something, either it's a foreign politician not praising China or a foreign brand having something in their advertisement that was viewed as criticizing China or not pro-China, they could have pushback in China. Because now also the people in China are thinking, we now have this economic power that we can punish you if you don't apologize, or if you continue to have this advertisements to make China look bad, then we can boycott you. Then you will have to come back and then apologize.
Right. So economic power growing, military power expanding. And what you're telling me, Shuang, is some alignment from the populace in terms of China's role within the world. Should the United States and other Western powers and even the world order as we've known it since World War II, should it feel threatened? And how should it react?
I personally feel from both sides, there needs to be more conversations. I feel the way that people inside China view the world, there's a huge gap between people view it outside of China. We basically blocked all the major Western media. So people inside China, they don't read what's happening. And whatever news they're reading from Chinese sources, a lot of them cannot be viewed as news. There is no context, there's no facts. So they really don't know what's going on inside the world and how China is viewed. And then I think from outside of China, some people look at China's rise as a threat, but I feel there's a lot of conversation that can be done. A lot of it is misunderstanding. In some areas, I think they probably should view China as a bigger threat than it is today. But in some areas, there's more cooperation that could be done.
Mary Kay, misunderstanding Or should Washington, as it seems to be, feel threatened and push back and try to actually constrain the growth and the Belt and Road Initiative and all of these other aspects of China's power projection, of its interest in the South China Sea and the Nine Dash Line and all of these other manifestations of a rising China?
What I heard most consistently all along the way as I was reporting out this series was, offer us something better. If you don't like what China's doing in terms of giving us loans and making investments and building out infrastructure and 5G networks, you do that. You know, you come up with better innovations, you come up with the technology, you engage with us and you express genuine interest in being the kind of leader we want to work with. And I think, I mean, my personal opinion is I think that's a pretty good way forward for the United States to recognize that if it wants to keep the position it's had over the last 70 years, that's kind of what's needed because there's a close contender right now. And I wouldn't say that China's winning on the soft power front, but even in Italy, you know, when I went to the port of Trieste and the port of Venice, the managers there, the heads of the ports were saying, you know, we're not going to not develop, you know, and so if we don't have resources from you or from someone in the European Union, we're going to look for where we can get investments and resources. What we could do in this moment, rather than being afraid or rather than trying to suppress China, is to model different behavior, come up with technologies where our values are embedded in those technologies, and enact regulations on our tech companies that make sure that they don't do some of the same kinds of surveillance or invasions of privacy or whatever we're criticizing China for. It's just that on their side, it's governmental, on our side, it's commercial. So this is something that also came up in my reporting, that people were saying, yeah, well, you know, China spies on us. We learned from Edward Snowden that the US spied on us. So what's the difference? We might as well go with the cheapest equipment. I heard this in Europe. I heard this, you know, from Germans. I heard this from Italians. So as a society, as a country, as a democracy, there are values we believe in. There are freedoms we believe in. And I think what I heard most strongly on this reporting related to China versus the U.S. is step up and walk the walk. You know, we liked it when you did. Try doing that again.
That was Mary Kay Magstead and Shuang Li. Their new podcast series is called On China's New Silk Road. Thank you both for joining me today.
Thank you, Marcos.
Thank you.
Special thanks to the Global Reporting Center, which produced On China's New Silk Road with Mary Kay Magstead. Music in this episode is by Blue Dot Sessions and Higher Brothers. This program was produced in partnership with KQED, with funding from Chevron, First Republic Bank, Dentons, Asset Management Company, and Jonathan and Marit Visbal. World Affairs is hosting a special virtual event on November 18th. This is just not another Zoom webinar. Our annual Global Citizens Award program will honor former Governor Jerry Brown, oceanographer Sylvia Earle, and CalPERS CEO Marcy Frost for their work addressing the effects of climate change. KQED's Scott Schaefer will moderate the conversations with the honorees, and you can get tickets on our website at worldaffairs.org. Proceeds from this event fund programs like the one you're listening to now. This episode was produced by Joanne Jennings, Jared Sport, Andrew Stelzer, and Teresa Katsarilis. Temba Daniels provided research assistance. Tatum Senderbeck is our digital producer. Our technical supervisor is Jim Bennett. I'm Philip Young. Thanks for listening.